distance between one to the line and keep them.
If you got one that says something else, it's a, my private note, so please give them back. So, we've been talking for a couple times now about the ordinary mind, Cohen, and the conversations grew out of Cohen seminar in early November where we took up the Cohen. It seemed to really grab people in interesting ways, so we've been coming back to it. I'll read it again, then I want to briefly say a little bit about where we've been, and then we'll go some other places for a while. So, Jiazhou asked Nanchuan, what is the way? Nanchuan said, ordinary mind is the way. Should I try to turn toward it? If you try to turn toward it, you move away from it. How can I know the way if I don't turn toward it? The way has nothing to do with knowing or not knowing. Thinking you know is delusion, thinking you don't know is blankness. When you truly reach the way, it's as vast as space itself. How could we talk about this in terms of it's this or it isn't this? With these words, Jiazhou suddenly understood. One of the things we've been stressing is that because of the various meanings of the term way, that something that's true of most koans is pretty obviously true of this one. It's often said that when you take up a koan, there's in some sense a practice point that you learn something about how to practice Zen, and at the same time that there's a deep Dharma point, that there's something presented to you or suggested to you about a very deep truth of Dharma and the way things are. And that's especially on the surface here in a sense, because way, as we know, means both the path or the way to get there, and I think in Chinese, as I mentioned once, literally it means a sort of corridor or a hallway that you, you know, pass people on your way to someplace else. And we know also that the way is also the teaching, so it's how we go about learning what it is that we need to do. But at the same time, it's also the way things are, it's also the great Tao, it's also the movement of the universe, it's also, as Hakuin, I think it is, so maybe that's wrong, says is the, no, it's Great Master Ma, the deep samadhi of the universe, that the universe is the deep samadhi of the universe and that nothing has ever fallen out of it. So the universe as the dream of itself, out of which nothing other ever falls, is also a meaning of Tao. So that's really important, I think, and we'll be coming back to that in a couple of minutes. Another thing I want to remind you of is that I've been trying to stress that in an important way, if you get caught by something in the koan and take it up, it's really important to remember that it's a practice, that it's never intended to tell you, you know, you're going to do things this new way and you'll stop doing them in the old way and the new way is good and the old way was bad. It gives you another room to be in, another way to look at things, but it's not asking you to give up anything except for a while as a practice. The other thing it means, on the other hand, though, and this is sometimes a little hard to get in a koan seminar when we work on koans as a group, if you take it up as a practice, then, I'm not saying you have to do this, but if you do take it up as a practice, then you really practice with it. And so that gives you an opportunity to sink into it deeply, to have pretty odd things happen, to have your perspective on things shift and change. If you really sink into a part of a koan as a practice, you may get mesmerized by it. Things can seem a little tippy. Things can have that odd quality where suddenly things are kind of too loud or too soft or a little strange and disoriented and intensified. They can also seem really bright. They can also seem really soft. And it's really possible that as those kind of tippy things happen, that something shifts and something opens for you. That's one of the things that koans are really good at allowing to happen or facilitating. So the last couple times, the first time we talked about if you try to turn toward it, you move away from it. And again, we talked about that as a practice and not telling you never to turn toward anything. And then last time we talked about the way has nothing to do with knowing or not knowing. And among other things, we pointed out that since the quote-unquote object of knowledge, which isn't an object of knowledge, is the whole ball of wax, is the Tao, is everything that is the way, that you really never can step outside it to know it as an object. So if you have a notion that in practice there'll be some object over against you that you will come to know in a really clear way, that's not quite it. It's more as if you fall into something. Today I want to go back to the very beginning moment of the koan, or the the beginning of what Nanchuan says, which is simply ordinary mind is the way. And so the first thing I want to focus on a little bit is the notion again that that's a practice point, and that what it suggests again, and to work with this I think is to encounter a fair amount of frustration, a fair amount of flabbergastedness, maybe a certain kind of offendedness. You know, what do you mean ordinary mind is the way? I'm here to find some other mind. I'm here to do something else. I'm here to see or learn something else. The more you get returned back to ordinary mind is the way. So anytime you think that what your mind is doing now isn't the right way to practice, you get, you know, that gets emptied out and you get returned to simply the way things are for you at that point. That aspect of the koan is in some sense like other aspects of the koan that we've talked about, and maybe in particular if you try to turn away from it, if you try to turn toward it, you turn away from it. And so among other things, I think that's a sometimes difficult lesson in your own sense of dukkha, your sense of how unsatisfactory things are. So what would it mean to encounter a frame of mind or a stretch of time where things didn't seem dissatisfied or dissatisfying, where it didn't seem as if there were anything that you had to find someplace else rather than something here? So partly working with that notion of ordinary mind as the way in terms of a notion of practice is to be returned again and again to really where you are, even though there's a kind of itchy desire to get someplace else. What I want to focus on now, though, is that sense of the koan as inculcating at the same time a really deep Dharma point, and that would have to do with that sense of the way as not a path, but as the Tao. And what that suggests, if you're told that ordinary mind is the way, what you're told is not simply in line with the practice point. You know, if you want to get what practice can give you, don't turn towards some other sense of mind, return to your ordinary mind. But you're told in a kind of radically disconcerting way that the movement of your own mind is already the Tao, is already the thing that you're looking for. That simply the movement of your mind is the Tao, that there's nothing outside of that or nothing else to seek for. One of the things I suppose that means is that, you know, a student asked Suzuki Roshi, you know, can't you just please tell us, it was David Chadwick actually, you know, can't you sum up your teaching in one phrase? And Chadwick apparently thought that was a preposterous question and Suzuki would never answer it. And Suzuki just said, everything changes. And so in some sense, the movement of your mind, thought after thought rises in the mind, thought after thought is the mind, is just your own local part of the universe where everything goes as it goes, everything changes, and to follow that movement, to be in that movement, is already to be in the Tao and to be the Tao. There are a lot of moments in the Blue Cliff Record where the compiler, Yuan Wu, has this odd thing that he says. He'll set up some kind of distinction, or he'll be riffing off a distinction by the other teacher in the Shuedo, and he'll say, I throw it over to the other side, really odd, and then he'll sometimes say, what other side, or other side of what? And there's this odd gesture that somehow in thinking about a problem or a koan, and I think this is true outside of Zen as well as inside of Zen, but we've kind of created this binary and there's this one thing on one side and something else on the other side. And there's this persistent move to take what you thought was on one side and throw it over to the other side and somehow disorient that and disconcert it. And that can be very, very odd. So I think one of the things that's really important about this, you know, ordinary mind is the way, if you think about it in terms of throwing it over to the other side. Let me talk about working with that in a kind of specific way and then what I think some of the implications are. So one thing that might happen is you're aware of, oh, you know, the cushion is green or the mat is green and the cushion is black or something like that. And then you might say, oh, I'm having that thought and that's the Tao, you know, that's the movement. And then you might say, oh, now I'm aware of myself having that thought. So that's the sort of me that's sort of standing outside the movement of all this stuff and watching the movement. And then you say, well, if ordinary mind is the Tao, then the thought about having the thought is itself part of it. And so it goes, you know, back and back and back, and it's a kind of misanabeam, the mirror, looking into the mirror. I've tried working on that the last couple of days since I knew this is what I wanted to talk about. And one thing I found happening sometimes is that after a while, we get kind of thinky and tedious. So there is kind of a, and this is true with almost any koan that you take up. And those of you who've worked with koans for a while certainly I expect, you know, I don't think it's just me, but you have those stretches where it kind of gets brittle or you don't quite see the resonance or it doesn't feel really deep. So you can have those moments where you say, oh, so now I'm having the thought about having the thought about having the thought. And it's a little bit like a parlor game. So there's that. The other thing I noticed, though, as I kind of went through that, is I noticed that someplace in there, and I kind of knew this, so, you know, it wasn't, there was a real sense of dread underneath there. You know, it's like, oh shit, you know. And I think what it has to do with, in some sense, in terms of this throwing it over to the other side, is that in some way, there's nothing that stands outside the stream, there's nothing left. So in some sense, if, you know, it's not a matter of knowing or not knowing, it's as vast as space itself, how can we say it's this or it's that? That creates that sense that, in some sense, there is no object that you can set over against yourself and say, oh, I know what that is, that you're always in the midst of it. In this one, in some sense, that sense of a subject, you know, the speaker, the self, who's apart from the process and can judge it and evaluate it and learn about it, that kind of tumbles in. So it really is, you know, thought after thought rises in the mind. Oh no, thought after thought is the mind. Aside from those thoughts, aside from those movements, there really is nothing left in reserve, and you can watch yourself kind of tumble into that endless process and not really be outside of it. And at that moment, there really is no I, there really is no self who's the lord and ruler of the whole show, who's standing apart from it, trying to know it, who's in some sense not immersed in it, is in some sense immune from or exempt from that endless unfolding of whatever it is that's going on. I don't want to get into this right now, but I hope for some of you who heard that that's related in some way to the Derrida talk that I gave a few months ago, and that we talked about that sense of Derrida talks about a sort of traditional Western model as there being a structure, and the center of the structure is somehow outside of the structure, it's the origin of the structure, it's not in play. So it's against that, you know, really just falling into the stream, falling into the Tao. Thought after thought rises in the mind, ordinary mind is the way, and you are that unfolding of thoughts, really is to throw the whole thing into the river in some way. I was thinking of the river metaphor also because it seemed to me, I was thinking of some of the things that Joan has said about sort of a brittle version of mindfulness. I think one of the things that happens to me sometimes in a retreat is I get very, very aware of my own self-consciousness and therefore my awareness of so many things moving and changing and going on around me. And there's a sense in some way that my mind has become very clear, and the part that's a little bit wrong is, you know, sort of therefore I'm standing on the shore and I'm sort of safely exempt from all this cool stuff that I'm seeing or sometimes disturbing stuff that's going on in the retreat. And I think the notion here is that, you know, there is no self standing on the shore in some way, that you're always in the river, you are the river, you're not apart from it. And again, I don't want to say that the moments where you say, oh, here I am, you know, I'm Tenny or I'm Jen and the world is over there and I'm here and I know who I am and tomorrow I'll be the same self and there's something stable here. That's not wrong, but in some sense, from a deeper point of view, that's really a trick, that's really an illusion, and in a kind of deeper way, there you are with everything else, melded in with it, changing and not exempt from any of it. There's an Elizabeth Bishop poem that John actually probably remembers. It's about dreaming, which is not what we're talking about, but it has this image of dreams as being this kind of armored car that let you, in some safe way, travel into the dangerous world of the unconscious. And then there's this image of sort of peering through the turret slits at everything that's out there, but kind of the dream, you know, maybe because it's only pretend or something, kind of keeps you safe. And I have a sense sometimes that to be a self is to be in that sort of armored car and, you know, here I am, I'm the knowing subject and the world is over there and I can kind of get it under control and so on. And so in this moment also, in some way, the armored car really, really dissolves and there you are in the midst of it. Those are the main points I want to make. I want to say, I guess, just a couple of other things. One, a little bit of a digression. I've told this story a couple times. It's a repetition of something that John Tarrant tells in a few places. He talks about a retreat where everything got really... He hadn't yet had any kind of opening that was significant. It's an early student story. And he had a retreat where everything got really still and really profound, And he thought, oh, now it's going to happen. It's really it, you know. And about half an hour later, as will happen, his mind was incredibly busy, you know, just da, 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 da. And he was really pissed off. And then he had this thought. He said, well, what if that's it too? And he said he just started laughing, and he said in some sense the laughter's never stopped after that. So there's that sense that, you know, rather than needing to find kind of the still point that's outside of everything, you throw yourself into what moves ceaselessly, and that's where the still point right is right there, but not in any way detachable from it. Joan talked this summer about finally being in a place where the sort of pilgrim's mind, where one abides nowhere and where everything is completely changing all the time, and being in the mind of the Zen teacher, the mountain, where one abides deeply and everything is still, that those two things are facets of a single thing, and neither one is really separable from the other. So what I want to suggest is that in that moment of ordinary mind as the way and falling right into it, that that's where the stillness is also, but it's not separable, it's not safe, and neither are you, you know. So it's a really hokey-pokey practice where you need to throw your whole self in, and nothing is exempt, and that's the moment when everything is still and there's that center at the same time. And then of course the next moment it's not still, you know, you're doing something else, you're in another room, and that's fine too. So the other thing I wanted to do to end is just, this is something else that's turned up in a couple places for us, but just read a really short koan from the Blue Cliff Record, which we took up, some of us, at a retreat with Joan about 3 summers ago. So Dasri's fire at the end of the kalpa. And the kalpa is like a big shitload of time, you know, it's like the biggest sort of way of counting time in the Buddhist way of timekeeping. And it's often associated with, you know, each kalpa has to do with the birthing of a new universe. And when the universe ends, then, you know, that's the end of that kalpa. So a student asked Dashwe, it's clear that the fire at the end of this kalpa will completely destroy the universe. I'm still not clear whether there's something that won't be destroyed. Dashwe said, it will be destroyed. And the student is kind of incredulous, you know. It'll follow along with everything else. It will follow along with everything else, said Dasri. So that's also ordinary mind, is the way. So thank you, and I'd be really happy to hear any questions or comments or other ways of looking at this.
I have a question.
Yeah.
How does, you know, what, like, this particular koan and you know, just some of the different ways that you're talking about ordinary mind and so on, how does that relate to the ceremony that we had earlier? Yeah. Like the teachings there, some of them seem, you know, to express this particular philosophy. There's almost an ethical component in some of that. And I'm just wondering what's the relationship between these two different things?
I don't know if I know how to answer that. It's a really good question. I don't know how to answer it in with one answer. I mean, in a way, my answer would be, oh, for me now, that's just ordinary mind. You know, there I am, you know, floating along with the various sutras, each one of which says something a little different. They don't all say the same thing. Some of them resonate for me. Some of them don't. In terms of the ethical part of it, I mean, there's something really antinomian about Zen practice, so there's a tendency not to want to sort of set up external reliable rules and precepts. So if you actually take up the precepts, they turn out to be really bendy in a way that's kind of disconcerting. And then, I mean, what people say is that can get a little too weird, and so in some sense then in sort of traditional Chinese practice, then Confucianism needs to come riding in, you know, to the rescue and saying, well, that's all very well, but nevertheless, you know, don't sleep with your mother, or what, you know, whatever it is. But Shibayama, who's a great Japanese teacher, talks a lot in his commentary on some of the koans. He'll say, well, people talk about this as if it were merely an ethical point, but if it were merely an ethical point, it wouldn't be a koan. And so he says what the koans do is they take us to a level of experience out of which ethics arises. Okay, so my sense would be that that kind of ethical moments in the sutra service are often about that. So and that that in turn is about immersing yourself in the flow of Tao and just the way that, that the ordinary mind koan is about. So, you know, with what you gain from just one sitting, all your crimes are wiped away. Well, there's a level on which that's completely preposterous, you know, and so, I mean, that's like a koan, you know, what is this bullshit? I mean, that's not true. But if you sit for a while and if you sit with that part of the sutra service for a while, maybe there begins to be some resonance where, oh yeah, there is some sense in which when you sit, your crimes are wiped away. And then sort of a typical Zen thing, I think the reaction would be, so once you reach that point where all your crimes are wiped away, then you're really aware of your crimes and you really know that you need to make amends for them. You know, so it's not one or the other. Does that begin to answer that? Or? I mean, I'm really aware in the sutra service just of my ordinary mind in relation to it. Now I'm bored by it, now I'm annoyed by it, now I'm really moved by it. Now I want to cry. Now Jen did something funny, so I want to laugh. Now it's boring again. You know? Now I'm thinking about what I'm going to have for dinner. I mean, all that stuff. And I'm also very aware, and this is the sort of musical part that Richie Domingue did, I'm really aware of being carried along with that. And the other thing I'll say is that if you do the sutra service every morning in a multi-day retreat with us, for a lot of us, I think there's that feeling about sort of being carried along on the sort of rhythm and the waves of the melodies and the sutras, so they kind of turn up. And I mean, that is ordinary mind. That is the movement of Tao. It's like the tunes that Richie wrote for some of the sutras. So.
When you're talking about the still point being in the midst of everything happening, I just had this image from when I was used to go whitewater canoeing. And you know, you're going through incredibly turbulent water, but you are in this really still place of movement. So. Yeah.
Yeah. I like that image of the armored car.
Isn't that funny?
And then just the dissolving of it.
Yeah. Marie said something really nice last week about listening to sound, and sometimes she just hears the sound, though usually it's like, oh, that's the sound of an airplane, there are people riding on it, I wonder where they're going, and you know, all those things. So what we were talking about in a way is that sort of all the conjecture and the model making that we do, which is great, and we ought to do it, you know, but it really is, it creates this sort of, you know, us, them kind of thing, or me, everything else, you know. I mean, Emerson talks about how there's like, you can divide it all into two categories. There's the I, and there's everything else, you know. And sometimes it has that feeling, and the sense sometimes in a retreat or doing a koan or doing the sutra service that it dissolves and you're just in the middle of it and it is you, you know, seems really, really beautiful. And I guess what I always thought is that, like, that the stillness would be something really, really different from everything else and exempt from it and all, and that it isn't at all, you know. But so that also means that you don't get out of the kalpa-ending fire, right? You know. Is there anything else?
I'm just thinking that Deborah and I were talking on the way here about getting out in nature and how renewing that is and how it helps me, and I think all of us kind of jump into the be the river or feel the part of it all when, you know, rather than in a room of books and things where it's the mind centered. Yeah. And with the solstice coming up too, it's another opportunity to help us in the experience of that, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, that real bareness is really, really important. Joan talks about that so much, right? The sort of seasonal aspects of our practice and that, just that And we were reading also Midwinter Day, you know, the long Bernadette Mayer poem about, it's a whole book that she wrote in a day that's apparently, you know, about exactly the shortest day of the year. And there are moments where it just sinks into that, and it's still moving in a way, and it's really still at the same time.
Just sitting with that is just really cool. Yeah. You know, the darkness and the shortness and the inevitable change.
Well, when we were, when I was sitting over at Zen Desert Sangha, which is kind of a bigger operation, they used to have a New Year's sit, which was pretty neat. And that's a little past midwinter, but I mean, it had some of that feeling, you know, we're going to sit up through midnight and just really sit in the darkness at the dark time of the year. You know, it's really beautiful. Yeah. We should find a way to do some little version of something like that sometime, you know, where we sit late one night in the wintertime. Mm-hmm.
I still have my memories of retreats, which have always been in the winter because I haven't gone with you guys in the summer, is cold and dark. Mm-hmm. And and I like that.
Well, and even though it wouldn't be a retreat, just our regular sit next Sunday, the day after the solstice, we can just be holding some intention.
That's great. Thank you. That's great. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you, everybody.